trick-or-treating likely to
be. Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
I'm just gonna say it and I don't care who get mad. Shouldn't no grown, able-bodied people be freaking out about no food stamps. If you got two legs, two arms, you can get up and talk on the phone, you can get up and take your behind to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And already you're starting to see the severe lack of any sympathy for people on food stamps. Now, do I share that lack of sympathy? In many of the cases, I do, because we found out that about half of all the food stamp benefits in America are not going to Americans. They are going to non-Americans. In fact, many of them are going to illegal aliens. But even among generic food stamp recipients, there's a certain amount of skepticism about why it is, as the man said, if you've got two arms and two legs, you can take yourself down and put yourself to work. Now, that's a legitimate question, except for a long time, a lot of us have been shamed out of asking that kind of question. And I have a feeling in the next 3 days between now and Saturday morning is the day that ordinarily those food stamp benefits would refill all those tens of millions of EBT cards around America. I mean, that's shocking enough just to begin with, because in America, you have one of the most prosperous, if not the single most prosperous countries on planet Earth. I guess you could argue that some of those tiny little Arab countries that are sitting on an ocean of oil are actually per capita more prosperous than the United States. But in the United States, you have 1/3 of a billion of the most prosperous consumers in the world. You've got an unemployment rate that is essentially what the economists call full employment at 4%. The Federal Reserve just decided to drop interest rates another 0.25 point or 25 basis points if you're one of those people who are serious about financial talk. But all of this stuff is going very, very well. And then you've got the Democrats who have decided that they will starve as many people on food stamps as they have to be able to get health insurance benefits paid for by taxpayers to benefit illegal aliens to the tune of $200 billion a year. That is one of three major demands that the Democrats have made. The Republicans offer them a bill to fund the government. They offered them that bill back in July when the House of Representatives passed it, and then the Democrats said no. They said no in mid-September. They have said no another 13 times in the last 4 weeks or so. The Democrats have said no, we will not vote to fund the government. And why? Because they want three major things. Number one, there was a gigantic expansion of Obamacare subsidies to the point where it was essentially free. It wasn't just subsidized. When you're paying for 87% of health insurance for families up to $500,000 in annual income, that is government-funded health care. That ain't a subsidy. A subsidy is when somebody pays a portion, a small portion of something. When you're paying for 87%, you're essentially paying for the whole thing. And then you've got this, a deliberate effort by the Democrats to confuse people. Because already you're seeing some conservative states in America that have said, okay, if the Democrats have decided to shut down the federal government, we will tide the program over SNAP benefits known as food stamps to most people. Virginia is a good example of that, where they said we will pay for it for a while, but it can only be for a while. Now, other states could do the same, but the blue states aren't going to do it because they're in league with the Democrats. The Democrats want to starve people. They want people screaming and yelling about the loss of their SNAP benefits, except, as I just pointed out to you, there are some people out there, like the gentleman you just heard, saying, hey, if you've got two arms and two legs and you can walk, go down and get yourself a job. And then you get this. I got an email today, and Brian Manzo asked a question that a lot of people have been asking me. He said, Lars, there's approved funding for SNAP benefits through the end of this year. That's not actually true. He says the Department of Agriculture has the power and the legal obligation to the people to release those funds right now. But your dear leader, clearly Brian Manzano or Monzo, is somebody who doesn't like Donald Trump. But your dear leader has ordered the head of the Department of Agriculture to withhold that funding for leverage against the Democrats because he knows his loyal and misinformed base will blame it all on the Democrats, just like you're doing. This administration is cruel and inhumane. I have to say, politely, Brian, you are misinformed. Does the Department of Agriculture have an emergency fund of $6 billion? They do. Is it by law only allowed to be spent in emergencies? Like, let's say a gigantic hurricane hits a corner of America. That's happened in a couple of times in the last couple of years. Are they allowed to use the money during an actual emergency? Yes. Are they allowed to spend that money in something that is not an emergency for anybody except the Democrat Party? By law, they are not allowed to spend it. But let's suppose they could. How far would $6 billion take the food stamp program if U.S. Department of Agriculture had the legal authority to actually spend the money, which they don't? It would take you about 20 days into November. And why is that? Because 1 month worth of SNAP benefits, believe it or not, costs American taxpayers $9 billion, which means $6 billion would only carry you to a few days before Thanksgiving. Nothing beyond that. And you would have spent down the entire emergency fund that is there for actual emergencies. What this reminds a lot of us of is when Joe Biden decided to use the National Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And what was the emergency he was answering? His poll numbers were down. That was back when Joe Biden was still running for office and when he had people, Democrat friends of his, who wanted to get better poll numbers in an election. That was Joe Biden's emergency, and that's why he burned down about half of our strategic petroleum reserve, which we're now going to have to refill. Joe Biden considered that an emergency. This is not an emergency. They're not allowed to spend the $6 billion. And even if they did, it would carry the program about 3 weeks into November. So do they have the money to fund SNAP benefits? They do not. Could they have the money to fund SNAP benefits? Yes. All the Democrats have to do is vote for the bill that funds the government. Now, have Democrats already voted for it? Well, they voted no, as I said, 13 times in the last 4 weeks. Did some Democrats vote for the House bill to fund the government? They did. Now, did Republicans vote for the bill in the Senate? They did. Did some Democrats cross the line and vote for the bill to fund the government? They did. Did some independents, not Democrats, not Republicans, did two of them come out and vote for the bill to fund the government? They did. How many votes did that get them? 53. Is that a majority? Yes. Is it enough to pass the bill? No. You have to have 60 votes to pass the bill. And I think at some point, House Speaker, not House Speaker, the Senate leadership, Thune, is probably going to say, we are going to nuke the filibuster, throw the 60 vote requirement out, and we're going to pass this thing with 51 or 52 votes. They may have to do that. And why? Because the Democrats have said, if PBS and NPR don't get their funding, if illegal aliens don't get their health care, if we don't get the vast expansion of Obamacare that was voted during the pandemic for a specific emergency, the Democrats have said if we don't get $1.4 trillion in new funding and new expenditures by the government, then we are not going to vote to fund the government. Understand that that is what's going on. And if somebody says USDA has the money, they do not. Not money they can legally spend. Back in just a moment. Glad to have you with me. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. With
when he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, the same Portland leadership that ran the entire city into the ditch over the last 5 years now wants to stall the arrival of Donald Trump's National Guard. And stall is all it really amounts to. Let's review. President Trump activated the Oregon National Guard just a month ago. That came after Portland City Hall encouraged a siege of ICE offices for more than 100 days. And then a cooperative liberal federal judge, Karen Immergut, issued a temporary restraining order to block Trump's National Guard. Immergut is 100% unaccountable to the people tortured by the nightly Antifa terrorist riots. Three federal appeals judges then reversed Immergut, and now the city of Portland is demanding that 11 more federal judges reverse those judges. Even if Portland wins this round in front of the comically loony Ninth Circus Court, President Trump will almost certainly ask for an expedited appeal straight to the U.S. Supreme Court. President Trump has federal law, the U.S. Constitution, and plenty of historical precedent on his side. Three other presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, have dispatched troops to American cities over the objection of local officials to settle much smaller issues. As the best president of the 21st century puts it, we're going to have safe cities. Whether people like it or not, that's what we're doing. Local leaders in the riot city, they demand that the chaos continue. Go figure. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Rick McCullough writes in, Lars, my daughter and son-in-law are very liberal, and quite often we end up with these not very nice conversations that they usually bring up politics. So how do I explain to my daughter why the government is shut down? Of course, she blames Republicans. Other things she brings up, she thinks voting by mail is great. I tried to explain to her there's a lot of fraud. I don't have all the facts. Your loyal listener, Rick. Well, I wrote back to him. I said, about the shutdown, Republicans wrote a clean CR. That is status quo funding for the government, the kind of funding the Democrats have previously agreed to. Republicans and Democrats passed it by the House in July. Most Democrats voted no, but one voted yes. It nearly passed the Senate with Republicans, Democrats, and independent votes, but at 53-43, it fell short. Even though a majority voted to pass it, they needed 60 votes. Only the Democrats voted no. So the Democrats could now pass it in the Senate and Donald Trump would sign it. Only the Democrats oppose it with the majority of the Democrats voting no. Ask your daughter, given all those facts, and they are facts and you can verify them, how she sees the GOP is to blame. Also, Democrats refuse to vote for the bill unless $1.5 trillion in new spending is added to it. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous?
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Today's Daily Grill is going to this coalition of Democrat state officials who've now sued the Trump administration. They filed a lawsuit yesterday. They want a federal judge to force the release of food assistance funds, that's SNAP benefits, for 42 million people. Notice they said people, not Americans, since most of the recipients are not Americans. The attorneys general representing 22 states and the District of Columbia and three governors launched the lawsuit. Now, what are they demanding? They are demanding that the Trump administration release the $6 billion they have in an emergency reserve fund, which by law can only be spent during an emergency. Having Democrats refuse to fund the government is not an emergency. That is something that can be corrected. You just have to get some sense into the Democrats. I realize that's a tall order, but there it is. Our best email of the day is brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes. I hired them to do it for me, and it's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or call 855-CAP-THAT. Brandon Church writes in, Lars, could President Trump sign an executive order to fund food stamps until the government reopens? I'm going to give Brandon a very simple answer. No. And why? because the U.S. Constitution says the federal government cannot spend one dime of money unless the Congress appropriates the money. The Congress, including the Democrats who are voting no, have said, no, we're not going to appropriate the money. So the short answer is no. Could Donald Trump or any president sign an executive order to spend money without congressional approval? The answer to that is no. To your calls on this beautiful Wednesday, glad to be with you in the Pacific Northwest and glad to have you listening on the Radio Northwest Network. I honestly mean this. For almost 30 years, we've done everything we can to serve the needs of the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And I'm glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Let's start with Nick, who's listening to our flagship station, KXL, on the Radio Northwest Network. Nick, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how you doing? Hey, I just want to make a quick little tidbit about the food stamp thing. I know there are a majority of these people are, you know, using the system, right? But I've got a sister who runs a foster care, and she's got, I think, six kids right now. And, you know, she's getting cut off, you know, and it's been a big thing. So there are some people out there that, you know, aren't, you know, using the system. And, you know, I was in food stamps once when I was in college, and I think your caller yesterday said it's dang near hard to get off of them, and that's true. So,
well, but when you say a majority are using them, you mean using them legitimately. So your sister took on. No, they're not using them legitimately.
No, they're not.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm talking about the majority of people are using the system.
Yeah, they're abusing the system.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Well, and you know, God bless your sister for taking in foster kids. But I'd ask, if you take on foster kids and then say, but I have to have the government's assistance to do it, does that maybe suggest that you weren't in a position to take on the foster kids to begin with?
Oh, no, she wasn't. And it's my nephew's kids. And, you know, it's a whole big deal. But, you know, I don't agree with what Edith, but, you know, it's just kind of negative impacting her. And
by the way,
I sent her some money.
It's your nephew's kids that your sister has taken in as her foster kids.
Yes,
and she's now getting a government subsidy. What the heck's your nephew doing? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, he got terminally ill, couldn't take care of them anymore. And that's kind of how that happened. And
so he's on Social Security and disability and all that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, and he's terminally ill. How long has he been terminally ill?
This time last year, he got diagnosed, with testicular cancer and, catch it in time. Yeah. He's been in it and he's only, you know, 30, 31 years old, something like that. It's been very hard for him. I kind of hoped the kids would have went to foster kids. I didn't think my sister as a single person was able to take care of the kids, but right now she's really struggling with it. And, you know, but I do think something needs to be done because when you said $9 billion of tax is what that goes,
$9 billion a month is what that system costs. $9 billion a month is what America is spending. And we got the numbers the other day that the Center for Immigration Stats says that over half the food stamps go to people who are not American.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that they can audit this somehow in the future and, you know, figure out a better system, but I doubt it.
I kind of doubt it as well. Thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson Show. Actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And it's always my pleasure to welcome to the program the managing editor of Willamette Week, Aaron Mesh, to talk about tax measures and some of the tax issues that governments in the Northwest are talking about. Aaron, welcome back.
Good to be here.
So tell me about this. Why are measures 5 and 50 causing revenue loss for big cities like Portland? And isn't this kind of a self-created problem by the big cities?
Well, it's complicated. So we're talking about my favorite subject, compression. So, but let's start here.
Compression is complicated. Yep.
Yeah. So I don't want to start on the deep end. Let's start with some basics, which is that U.S. Bancorp Tower, which is commonly known as Big Pink, sold in July for $45 million.
Yep.
Now, how much Did it sell for in 2015? I bet you know this.
Nine times as much, 373.
Yes, 373.
Yep.
So that means that the reality of that is that, as you would expect, suddenly its property tax value has changed. So at that point, the new owners of a building go to the assessor, the property tax assessor, and say, and his name is Mike Vaughn, he's the Multnomah County assessor,
yep,
and say, this building, which you have been taxing at a rate as if it were worth $373 million, is now obviously not worth that much anymore.
Yep.
So the result of that is that the taxes collected on the building, on Big Pink, have gone down by 68%. From $2.7 million in property taxes in 2024 to $860,000 in 2020. That's an extraordinary loss of revenue for the city, for the county, for various local governments that are depending on these large properties in downtown to provide the baseline, to provide a lot of core city services.
And then we get to compression. Now, isn't that where Measure right. 5, which 30-plus years ago passed, and it was a great measure. I voted for it. I was an Oregon voter at the time. And he said, let's limit property taxes because they had grown to insane levels. And then after it passed, all the governments began whining and complaining and saying, no, we've got to have something that fixes this. And they couldn't repeal it. So they said, let's pass Measure 50, which just complicated the whole matter. Can you make that understandable? For folks,
I doubt it. So, like, if I'm being quite honest, I doubt that I can pull it off. I think that Anthony Effinger, who wrote this story, actually has managed to make it understandable. But I will do my very best, and then beg your readers to go read his story on WWeek.com or pick up a print copy. But in 1990, Don McIntyre passes, or successfully persuades voters to pass, Measure 5.
God
that
bless
caps him. That caps the amount of tax paid on any Oregon property at $15 per $1,000 of real market value.
Yep.
So then how many years later? 7 years later, in 1997, Bill Sizemore helps pass Measure 47, which Democrats, I believe, later fiddle with to create Measure 50. And both of them are intended to deal with what's called assessed value, which is different than the real market value. So that means that your taxes can only rise by 3% a year on the assessed value.
Plus levy.
So,
yeah. Yep.
So the reality of that is that you now have a combination cap on how much tax you can pay for $1,000 of real market value, and you also have a soft cap on how fast the assessed value can rise. And if I understand this correctly, you pay whatever the lower number is. So whatever's lower, the assessed or real market value is what the property tax is based on.
Yep.
So then what happens, and this is important, what happens when a property's assessed real value or assessed value changes is that,
you set a new baseline for that 3% increase, right?
Exactly. You got it.
There you go.
So at that point, then we're restarting the clock on how much the value can rise. We're starting at a new baseline. And so what is happening across the city, not just with Big Pink, is that property owners who have high assessed values in downtown are looking at what just happened to Big Pink and looking at the sale of Big Pink and saying that building, which had been assessed as being valued at $373 million.
Think of it this way, Aaron. $9 million a floor is what it sold for 10 years ago. $1 million a floor is what it sold for this year. That's an easy way
exactly.
to think about it. Yep.
That's a great way of putting it. And so let's say that you own a building that is two blocks down from Big Pink, two blocks west of Big Pink. Well, if you own that building, then you're looking at your tax bill and you're saying, wait a second, the building that is right next to mine just sold for $1 million a floor and it was being taxed at $9 million a floor.
Yep.
Why is my tax bill so high maybe my building actually isn't worth this much. And maybe I should appeal my property tax bill to the assessor. And so the assessor now expects that as many as 300 properties are going to be reassessed this year based on appeals they've received saying, come on, this isn't actually what my building is worth. And you know it's not what my building is worth because you just saw what Big Pink sold for.
I'd be surprised if it was only 300 because, Aaron, I've heard people talking, real estate folks that I know, saying, I sold condos in the Pearl District for $400,000, you know, 10 years ago, and they're now selling for $100,000 less than what they sold for 10 years ago. So not only did you not make money, you actually lost money. I'd be stunned if the people who own those things are not saying, well, I want my property tax bill reduced as well.
So this is the fiscal cliff, I think, that Portland is facing that is very scary. And like when people talk about a doom loop for the city, this is what they're really talking about, is that as buildings clear out and as people don't return to downtown, the value of the properties goes down. And when the value of the properties goes down, the amount that can be assessed, the amount of tax that can be levied on them based on the assessment goes down. And when the tax receipts go down, the amount of services that can be provided go down.
Meaning,
and then
police,
who wants to
fire,
come downtown with
those
services?
Yeah,
and then you don't have cops that respond to calls because there are not enough cops, and you don't have firefighters.
And then doesn't that pull the values down more? Because if you end up as the West Coast equivalent of Detroit, and you say, now we have all these buildings that are worth a tenth of what they were 10 years ago, and we have similar services, meaning you've cut fire, you've cut police, you've cut parks, you've cut every other service, and then the services go down, which means the tenants look at the place and say, hey, this place isn't attractive to live in anymore, and they depart, and then the value goes down some more.
This is why I have been frustrated by campaigns to like make everybody feel happy, fuzzy, go lucky about the status of downtown Portland over the past 5 years, is that if you don't confront these unpleasant realities, it's not as if like saying Portland is fine in media campaigns is going to bring the property tax values back up.
No.
So what are you achieving exactly?
Well, you have to actually change the circumstances downtown. You're right on the verge of endorsing bringing Donald Trump's National Guard to Portland, aren't you?
No, because here's why not. Because it doesn't have anything to do with downtown.
It doesn't?
No.
Did you see what he did in D.C.?
If Donald Trump's troops want to come into downtown, like, set up some food carts so that people actually want to come downtown, I will eat at a National Guard food cart.
I would sooner go to downtown and buy a hot dog from a stand run by a National Guard member than I would to buy a steak dinner from Keith Wilson or Tina Kotek. You can read the whole story by Anthony Effinger at WWeek.com. That's Aaron Mesh, the managing editor. Back in a moment, we'll talk about taxes and Governor Kotek.
Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday at 866-HEY-LARS. By the way, I got this from Floridian, who's in Oregon, but writes and says, Lars, so from everything I understand, illegal aliens don't qualify for SNAP benefits or Obamacare. Am I missing something? How would they benefit if the Democrats opened the government? Thank you. Have a great day. Let me explain it to you this way. There are Democrats and there are a lot of media running around saying, well, illegal aliens can't possibly be getting SNAP benefits or Medicaid because under federal law, it is illegal for them to get that. Now, I want to tell you how simplistic and simple-minded you have to be to buy that, because it would be like saying there are no murders in America. Now, everybody listening saying, Lars, of course there are murders in America. I said, no, there are no murders in America. Didn't you know murder is illegal? There are also no heroin overdoses because shooting heroin is illegal in America. Therefore, nobody in America ever dies of heroin or fentanyl or any other kind of drug because it would be illegal to have that drug and it would be illegal to take that drug. if you buy into that kind of simplistic logic that, well, if federal law says an illegal alien can't have food stamps, then they don't have food stamps. If you're that simple-minded, it is no wonder that you vote for Democrats. On that note, let's go to Aaron. Hey, Aaron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, I've been listening to most of the people that are getting food stamps, SNAP, are not American-born.
Yes.
Well, I look at my Gemini app, you know, the AI.
Yes.
And it
says, don't trust AI, please.
I always thought that was, I mean, I believed that the AI was truthful.
No. In fact, one of my producers, Aaron, Joel, is very smart, and he's much more hip to this stuff than I am. But I'm reasonably fast, too. AI has a disturbing inclination to try to make you happy. I mean, and so it will often, and I've given this because Joel gave me this example. There are lawyers who've gone to AI. I mean, these are AIs made to be used by lawyers and said, I need some previous court cases that would support the right of my client to do X, Y, or Z. And AI comes back and cites what appear to be real court cases. Aaron versus the state of Minnesota, Larson versus the state of Oregon. And you say, well, there they are. Those are the cases. And AI made it up 100%. And you say, why would AI do that? AI lies. And it doesn't lie all the time, but it does lie. And if you don't believe me, you know, just do a simple search for news articles about AI telling lies. It does it on a regular basis. And I asked Joel, I said, isn't there a way to, you know, say to AI, I want an answer to this question, and I want it to be a truthful, fact-based answer. Apparently, that doesn't always work. But what does AI say when you ask, are foreign nationals getting the majority of food stamps? What does it tell you?
It says, no, this is not correct. The vast majority of food stamp recipients are U.S. citizens, according to recent data from the U.S. Department, USDA, which administers the Supplemental Nutrition, the SNAP. Approximately 89.4% of SNAP participants were U.S. born. This means that less than 11% of SNAP participants are foreign born.
Now, do you know the scam that the food stamp program does? And they do this on a regular basis. So you're sitting there in the food stamp office, and a family of illegal aliens comes in, and they say, well, we're short on food. We need to get food stamps. And the food stamp office says, are you citizens? And say there are five members of the family and say, no, four of us are illegal aliens, but we have a child that they will say, this child was born in America. Whether that's true or not, they've understood if you say the right words, and the same thing works at the border. If you come to the border and say, I'm from Mexico, I want to come in, they say, no, you can't. You say, I'm from Guatemala, and I'm fleeing oppression. Oh, come on in. That was true under Biden. So you had to say the magic words. So what happened if you were from Mexico and you wanted to get into America? Aaron, what are the magic words you say when you get to the border? Are you from Mexico? Tell me. Are you?
I'm fleeing the border.
No, you're saying, I'm from Guatemala and I'm fleeing oppression, because those are the magic words. Yeah. It's like having a clubhouse when you're a kid and you have to have a secret password to get into the clubhouse.
Right.
Well, if you learn the secret password, you say whatever words are required. So the food stamp person at the state bureaucracy, which in a place like Oregon and Washington wants to give illegal aliens benefits, says, oh, your child is an American. Well, I will give that child enough food stamp benefits in the child's name. The child could be 6 months old, but they assign the food stamp benefits. So what does the food stamp system record as who those benefits went to? They went to an American-born person and their four family members. That's how they work that game. And it is fraud. I mean, it's the kind of thing.
Fraud. It's complete fraud.
I mean, if you or I pulled that kind of fraud, I mean, I'm 66 years old. I'll be 67 next year. If somebody was trying to sell me life insurance, say, what is it going to cost? They say, well, you're an old man. It's going to cost you a lot. I said, what if I told you I was 25 years old and weighed a buck and a half and I'd go running every day? They say, oh, we can get you a great deal. Great. Put me down as 25 years old. And you say, but that's fraud. Yes, it is fraud. And unfortunately, when the federal government gives the money to Oregon and Washington, which are sanctuary states, and Oregon and Washington say, we want to put these benefits in the hands of people who are not legally entitled to get them. So we're simply going to engage in fraud. If you or I did it, we go to prison. If Governor Kotek and Governor Ferguson do it, they get reelected. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson
Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday and glad to take your phone calls and emails on the Radio Northwest Network. I want to talk about an activist that you've heard from time to time on this program. It's Tim Iman. I haven't talked to Tim Iman in quite a time. He now faces about $8 million in fines he can't pay. He's losing his home. He's losing his career. And should the courts protect people from punishments that literally ruin their lives? Or if you decide to play the game, and then in this case you lose in court, and the damages add up to enough, is this something that is reasonable to do? I thought we'd ask Joanna Talcott, who is she's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. And Joanna, welcome to the program. There aren't a whole lot of subjects that I find myself ambivalent about, but this is one of them. Because I've thought well of Tim Iman for a long time. He is the most prolific citizen activist the last two decades. The problem is he got into some trouble over campaign finance reporting violations. He went to court. He fought it. He lost. In the end, it really kind of ruined him, and it continues to ruin him. Welcome to the program, and tell me what's going on with this and what we should do that would set this right.
Thanks so much for having me. So we're representing Tim in his second appeal. The first time that he appealed the judgment, which as you mentioned was $2.6 million in fines and another $2.8 million in attorney's fees. After he initially appealed those, the Court of Appeals remanded back down to the trial court to answer one very important question: whether those fines violated the excessive fines clauses of the state and federal constitutions, because Iman didn't have an ability to pay them. And not just an inability to pay, but it would take Tim several lifetimes to pay up these fines. With the 12% interest, the judgment, as you mentioned, now exceeds $8 million and is growing by $700,000 annually, which is about $58,000 a month. There aren't a lot of people that could manage even 1 month's interest in that
regard. No, I couldn't. I couldn't do it.
No. But,
can we go back to the very beginning of this just for a moment and tell me this?
Sure.
Did he fail to properly report the campaign? Everybody who runs for politics in most states has to file what are called CNEs, contribution and expenditure reports. You have to say, where did you get the money contributed to your campaign? How did you spend the money? Did he violate those rules?
Well, that's what the court held, and that was what was adjudicated, and we're not appealing any of those.
No, I understand
issues.
That. I just want people to understand, you know, he failed to do the things you're required to do if you choose to take part in these campaigns. So he fought it. And he fought it unsuccessfully. And the court decided, well, you did violate the rules. How did they end up with $2.5 million in fines alone for all that? Was it just multiple upon multiples of these violations or what?
Yeah, for a lot of the fines, they just fined him an amount equivalent to what the, you know, reported the violation was. So if he misreported $138,000, that was what the fine ended up being. But this also includes a lot of sanctions, as I mentioned, the $2.8 million in attorney's fees that also were tacked on. So that's how it grew to be this enormous amount, especially with the 12% interest.
I mean, because, you know, failure to report is something that I even the national campaigns do this. I think Obama had to pay about $3 million in reporting fines, although he ran, you know, multiple hundreds of millions of dollars spent, and he had to pay $3 million in fines. A lot of the bigger campaigns tend to look at these as, well, that's the cost of doing business. We're going to make mistakes. We'll just pay it. But for somebody like Tim, it was pretty much a one-man band when it came to sponsoring 17 statewide ballot initiatives. He's running the whole thing on his own, and I assume he's getting some accounting help to try to make sure. And he's been doing it long enough. He should know how to report the monies correctly, but he didn't, and he owes the $2.6 million. Although, on its face, does that violate the federal Constitution's protection against excessive fines, saying because you didn't file the right paperwork on this money, we're going to charge you that amount of money?
Well, not on its face. When you're looking at an excessive fines analysis, you consider the gravity of the fine, the culpability of the offender, and other factors that ultimately will help you decide whether the fine is proportional to the offense. But for us, the most critical question comes down to Tim's ability to pay.
Yeah. And should that factor into it? So if it was Bill Gates, you'd say, well, he can afford it. It's walking around money for him, or Bezos, or one of those folks. But when it comes to Tim Iman, this was his livelihood, running these ballot measures. And I think a lot of people, including me, were glad that he ran these statewide ballot measures, including Initiative 695 on car tab fees. We wouldn't have had them but for somebody like him.
Right. I mean, I think it has to be considered, and this is not some relatively new legal protection. This dates back to 1250 Magna Carta. I mean, these are kind of fundamental, foundational rules behind our Constitution that ensure that you can't go after people and completely destroy their livelihood. These are violations, no doubt. The court held that he made these violations, but it's also Tim engaged in political speech. So I think there is a little bit of a recognition that it's difficult to say that somebody should be absolutely crushed for engaging in political activism.
Well, and let me ask you about that. There was an idea called slap suits, selective litigation against political participation. And the idea was that if you didn't like somebody, no matter which side you came from, if you didn't like the Sierra Club, you'd hit them with a slap suit. And you try to tie them up with enough damage that they were effectively silenced. And I don't want to see that used against either side, frankly. I want our system to be one that invites political participation and one that doesn't say, if we don't like the way you're taking part, do you suspect that that is part of what the state of Washington is doing through the courts and through these rules to say, we're going to go after people like Tim Iman and we're going to put him out of business? Meanwhile, if other folks who we like, Maria Cantwell, Patty Murray, Bob Ferguson, they do things, yeah, we're not going to hit them nearly as hard. Is there a case to be made that this is a form of slap?
I'm not going to speculate about the motives of Washington State, but I do think that there are facts and circumstances that would lead a lot of people to make that conclusion. So, like I said, it's not something I'm willing to speculate on, especially not being a citizen of Washington State.
Can you win this one for Tim Iman?
I think we have a very strong case. As I mentioned, this really comes down to his ability to pay and whether or not he's had his livelihood and life's work completely devastated by these violations. And I want to make another point. One of the things that the court recognized is that some of these provisions that he was accused of violating were in fact ambiguous. And the court ultimately construed them in favor of the state, which is kind of a bit of a reversal from a lot of criminal codes that engage in the rule of lenity and saying that, you know, we're not going to hold you liable for committing an offense that isn't entirely clear on the face of the law.
That's a very good way to put it. Johanna Talcott is an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Johanna, thanks very much. Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk about Barack Obama sticking his toe in the water this year politically. Hey, what if you could
email
talk at LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you are a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, if I started out by saying that Barack Hussein Obama is about six kinds of hypocrite every day of the week, you'd say, Lars, don't give us stuff we already know. We know that Obama is a hypocrite, but I love being able to bring you new examples of Barack Obama's hypocrisy. You see, I think Barack Obama was a tremendous opportunist. He decided to run for president. He told us when he got the first nomination from the Democrat Party, he said, this will be the moment when the earth begins to heal itself. He was saying that people are going to look back on the moment of his nomination as the day in which the earth began to heal itself, the oceans stopped their rise and blah, blah, blah. He clearly has a very high opinion of himself. His wife, even worse, because Michelle Obama, who hates America with a passion, she actually said after he was nominated and elected, it was the first time in her life that she was proud to be an American. Now, this is a young lady who grew up with a middle class family, ended up going to Harvard Law School. I mean, she accomplished a lot, at least on paper, not so much in her hatred of America. But she decided that the only time she'd ever been proud to be an American was when her husband was chosen as president of the United States. And then he went through 8 years and didn't do much of anything for us except deliver a lot more power into the hands of Joe Biden, who then used the power to make millions of dollars for his own Biden crime family. But enough about that. Let me point this out to you. I want to remind you that about a year ago, there was an election and one person lost and the best president of the 21st century won. That would be Donald Trump. And it was Kamala Harris who lost. And Barack Obama, who didn't get out on the campaign trail much at all for candidates, but he did go out. And in one of these appearances he made, he was talking to maybe a couple of dozen black individuals, young men. And he was talking to them about why they should vote for Kamala Harris. And he made the argument, I'm going to let you hear some of what he had to say. He seemed kind of hesitant as he was saying it to these young men. But he basically said, because you're black and she's black and you have a shared experience with her, that's a good reason to vote for Kamala Harris as president, because she shares your life experience. Listen.
And on the one hand, you have somebody who grew up like you, knows you, went to college with you, understands the struggles and pain and joy that comes from those experiences.
Yeah, all the pain and the joy and blah, blah, blah. So Obama is saying, because you have a similar background, you're black, she's black, you have common experiences of being black Americans, vote for her because she's black and she's like you. Well, guess what's happening now? Obama is back on the campaign trail. And as I said, he doesn't show up on the campaign trail for the Democrats much. I mean, once he was done being president and he was worth, I don't know, $100 million or so because of book deals and Netflix deals and things like that, I don't think he feels much need to get out and even help the Democrat Party. And of course, the Democrat Party is going down like the Titanic. And I think Obama would rather hang out with rich people on their yachts than go out on the Titanic of the Democrat Party. But he showed up in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And who is he backing there? Well, there are two candidates running for governor of Virginia. One of them is Winsome Earle Sears, who's been on this program quite some time ago, but she's very accomplished. She is the Republican lieutenant governor of the state of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And then there is Abigail Spanberger, who's more than a little bit Looney Tunes. Now, Abigail Spanberger is the Democrat. She is also a white woman. And Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earle Sears is is the Republican. She's currently the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, and she is the black American who's running for office. Now, do you suppose that Barack Obama went out and said, well, you've got this woman who shares some of your common experience in Winsome Earle Sears? Nope. It turns out that Abigail Spanberger is getting Barack Obama's backing. And why? Does she have anything in common with the experiences of voters, black voters? Obama's ditched that argument at this point. He only used it for Kamala Harris, and I think only out of desperation, because I think that Obama knew that Kamala Harris didn't have a snowball's chance of being elected president of the United States. So now he's completely ditched the argument that if you have a common life experience with a candidate, because I would imagine that when it comes to Abigail Spanberger, Black Americans don't have much in common with her other than a political party. Here calls now. Let's go first to Jennifer. Hey, Jennifer, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Lots is on my mind. I haven't listened to you in a while, but I wanted to pop in and see what's happening
side. I'm sorry to hear that. Well, I hope we can bring you back. So, anyway,
No, I pop in every once in a while. I'm an NPR listener, but probably tells you something.
You drank the Kool-Aid? You like state-controlled media?
Oh, I like good media. I like
the kind that's paid for by government.
Paid for by me because I'm a contributor. But so,
well, they claim they're going, cutting left and right because they lost all that cash. But anyway.
Lots of hypocrisy here. Still baffled by this side of the aisle that they want to, you want to spend your time talking to people about, how, poor and SNAP benefits and immigrants getting health care are the problem when it's not.
Immigrants or illegal aliens? Is an immigrant an illegal alien? Because
an illegal alien. And you get my point. It's that we're still talking about it like the billionaires aren't the problem, like the politicians.
How are the billionaires the problem? Help me out with that one. How are they the problem?
Lars, you're a smart man. You said you're in your 60s a little bit ago. You want to waste your time, talking about that. You know how billionaires are the problem.
You've dropped a mystery in my lap. I want to know, how are billionaires the problem?
You're just playing dumb.
No, tell me what you mean by they're a problem. They pay a huge amount of taxes.
The people of the United States of America. The problem is that they're on their super yachts employing Americans while Americans are struggling to get health care. Yes, that's a problem. Yes.
They pay more taxes than you or I put together forever and ever, and they employ lots of people.
And I know, because of the career that you've chosen, that if you weren't devising people and not speaking the truth, you wouldn't have a career. So let's talk about, while there's Americans suffering and hungry.
How am I devising people? I'm not sure what devising means, but you mean dividing people? I'm telling people point of view, and I always identified. So how am I dividing people?
Everything. It's like you call the Biden the crime family, and it's like...
Are they not a crime family?
...is a felon.
If they're not a crime family, why did Hunter need a pardon?
Is the president of the United States
if they're not a crime family, why did Hunter need a pardon?
Why is Donald Trump a felon? And you don't care about that.
Because of political lawfare in New York State. And by the way, I think he's going to beat that case.
Sure.
But I ask you a question. Jennifer, would you answer my question? I like the idea that we're going to improve the White House with donated money instead of taxpayer money. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing he can do.
Tell me what's wrong with having the White House improved by donor money. Obama spent
The government is shut down and Americans don't have
health. And the ballroom is being paid for with private donations. Now, when Obama spent $400 million on the White House, all of us paid the bill. The ballroom is going to be built with private donations. Jennifer, God bless you in your confusion.
The Lars Larson Show. Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to first present to my friend Leland Vittard, host of On Balance and chief Washington anchor at News Nation. President Trump claimed $17 trillion in foreign investments in just 8 months of his presidency, says by the end of the year, at the end of 12 months, we will probably hit $21 trillion in new foreign investment. But the left says that's wildly inaccurate. Now, Leland is the author, among other, it's his first book called Born Lucky. You didn't write another book before you wrote Born Lucky, did you?
I did not.
Okay. Then that's his first book. It's the first of many to come. I'm going to make that promise right now. How are you, Leland?
I'm doing well. It's good to be with you, as always, my friend.
Well, it's good to have you on the program. Let me ask you about this, because Trump is saying there's been $17 trillion in foreign investments in the first 8 months. Now, I think the investments are probably both cash and also things like, what was it, General Electric announced they're building a $500 million washing machine factory in Kentucky or West Virginia or somewhere. And all of that is good for America. Do you think he's exaggerating this?
Well, I don't know anything that Donald Trump hasn't exaggerated.
That's true.
Okay. Number two, you know, there's an old reporter in D.C., I think actually one of the best reporters I've ever known, who makes the comment about things like this, important if true. I would add important if it happens, right? Because this is not, you know, irrefundable airline tickets that have been purchased or non-refundable airline tickets. This is promises made by CEOs so that there's big announcements. Yeah. Now, when those investments happen, who knows if they even happen before Trump leaves office. I tend to think that none of this really matters, all these announcements and talk and everything else, because people know how they feel. In the same way it didn't matter when Joe Biden got up there and said, the stock market's doing great. We have low unemployment. Everything's wonderful around here. The economy's great. You don't understand how great the economy is. That didn't matter either.
No, but hold on. When he said it, it was provably untrue. I mean, we could watch. I mean, when Joe Biden said, when I came into office, inflation was 9%. And all of us looked at each other and went, no. Provably, I mean, he would say stuff that was just crazy. But do you think that Trump is unaware of the fact that that there are investments being made, many of them are being made because he's made the United States more favorable from a tax standpoint, from an employment standpoint, and in a regulatory way, hasn't he?
Well, I think all of those things are true.
Okay.
And what I'm telling you is I think that whether or not $21 trillion is invested or not, it might happen. I think what is more important, though, is how people feel.
Yeah.
$21 trillion can get invested, and if people don't feel better, if there's not more room for them at the end of the month, if they're still paying record high prices for beef, it ain't going to matter. And the flip side is also true. If all of a sudden more baristas in New York are out of work and relying on public assistance, and New York City goes even further south because of Mom Dami's state-run grocery stores, and the middle of America and Pennsylvania and Iowa and Georgia and North Carolina are on a tear, and Michigan, because of all of this $21 trillion of investments, then it ain't going to matter a lick either. And you're going to have Republican House, Senate, and White House for decades to come. My point being is that just, you know, these sort of celebrations of, oh my God, there have been all these promises. Well, that's fine. Show me the money.
Okay, but Leland, I'll make the argument for why I think they're important. And by the way, my audience knows I disagree with Trump, and I say so on the air when I do. But in this case, here's why it's important. Because if you say, if the country only did X, we would get more companies investing. We'd have more companies building factories here instead of, you know, in Guangzhou province. And you say, well, how do you know? You say, well, Trump is saying we've got all these companies that are committing. You've made this a good place to do business again. We're going to build factories there. Whether they happen next year or next week or next decade really doesn't matter, as long as they plan to do it. And if the answer is they're doing, why are they doing it now and they weren't doing it under Biden? Because we've made this a more friendly environment. I'll go to your barista example. I don't much like Starbucks. I've got nothing against them. I don't have any, you know, financial stake elsewhere. But I walk in there and I get treated by these arrogant baristas like it's my privilege to be ordering a $5 cup of coffee from somebody with a snooty attitude behind the counter. If somebody new came in and said, you know what, we're going to change the corporate culture. We're going to start greeting people as customers and thanking them for coming in and bringing business. And you do that, and your boss says, well, it's been 2 or 3 months. What's happening? You say, well, revenues are up. We've got more customers coming in, and we'll probably have more in the future because we now treat people nice instead of treating them in the snotty way that most people at Starbucks treat you. You have to show there's a connection between change the environment, get more business, right? And if you don't brag about the fact that, hey, sales are up, and the only thing that's changed is the snotty barista has now become the happy, friendly barista, and that change brought more customers in. If Donald Trump is saying a welcoming America that makes us a good place to do business has more people bringing their business here and fewer of them taking them to Malaysia.
There's a lot of bounces in that logic. I'm still back at the barista and my $5 cup of coffee.
Okay. Arrogant barista. Sorry. Leland.
Right. I thought you were going to say pink hair, but that was a different
thing. Well, that too, and the nose ring or the cattle ring or whatever they have in their face,
Okay, so I just go back to, look, it's wonderful if it actually happens. You know, what I think is interesting, and I say this, I've yet to see, and I would think the president has some very good advanced people, I've yet to see Donald Trump show up at five of these factories and barnstorm around America in Air Force One and go, I'm here in whatever Kentucky where they're building washing machines, and I'm here in Texas where they're doing this, and I'm here in Nebraska where they're doing that, on and on and on, all thanks to my investment. If those factories were being built right now, he would be doing that. And my point
in eight months, you're expecting a lot faster permit approval than I think most companies get.
That's the point I'm getting at is that the way people vote, if that's what we're talking about, the way people vote is based on how they feel, not what has been promised or press releases. So I think it's fantastic. And I hope for America that it comes true because it will be great. My point being to you and for all Republicans, from what I'm hearing in my reporting, much of America is really hurting right now.
Yeah, they are.
And the Republicans would be very wise not to make the same mistake that Joe Biden made by not expressing that he understands their pain.
The author of Born Lucky, but Leland, I understand what you're saying, but to some extent, I think Trump realizes because a lot of these things like the washing machine factory in Louisville is going to take some time. So what he's got to do is give you the sniff of the steak that's coming from the kitchen. Steak hasn't arrived on your plate yet, but you can smell it. You can hear it on the barbecue, and you understand it's on its way. Hasn't got there yet, but the cook has to open the door and let you smell a little bit of what is going to come because, you know, how long does it take to build a $500 million washing machine factory in Lexington? It's going to take a while. So in the meantime, you get a little bit of advance notice from the president saying it's coming, and it's coming because we change things. That is the author of Born Lucky, and you'll find him at News Nation. He's Leland Vittert. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network and always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our X poll question, should public schools e-verify all their teachers and dismiss those not legally in the country? And you say, Lars, you're crazy. There aren't any illegal aliens who are working as teachers. Well, Colorado found at least one, Marina Ortiz Abolneda, who is an illegal alien from Peru. Not just an immigrant, not just a foreign national, but an illegal alien working at the Global Village Academy, Douglas County in Colorado. So she's working at a taxpayer-funded public school run by the government, just arrested by ICE along with her family. She now faces deportation. One wonders, when you're told that illegal aliens do all those nasty jobs that Americans don't want to do, including the well-compensated teachers working in public schools, well, that too, perhaps. Well, In any case, you know that you're in trouble as a Democrat governor of the state of Oregon in this case. I mean, Ferguson's in trouble, too. But Governor Tina Kotek goes off on a $200,000 junket with her mentally ill and alcoholic spouse to Asia while her state has a major decision that she has not signed yet. The legislative special session about a month ago signed the biggest tax increase, a $4.3 billion gas tax bill. And then she decided to leave the state and even leave the country without signing the bill because she wants to deny to Oregonians the opportunity to refer that to the ballot and then vote on it. Because I think Kotek knows to a fair certainty that if it gets on the ballot, voters are going to vote this piece of garbage down. And in fact, there's some good polls out there right now that say about 80% of the voters oppose this gas tax increase. So Tina Kotek is desperate to make sure that nobody gets to vote on it. But now she's got members of her own party. For example, Jeanine Solman, who is an Oregon state senator, Democrat from Hillsboro, says many Oregonians across party lines believe that delaying action on this legislation limits the window for opponents to pursue the referral process. Preserving the full opportunity for civic participation is essential to democratic governance. I worry that waiting till the statutory deadline, as Kotek is doing, is undermining public trust. After months of work to bring this bill to your desk, she's addressing Tina Kotek directly, many Oregonians are seeking closure. I respectfully urge you to move forward with your signature without delay. A second Democrat, and that's Jeff Golden, Oregon State Senate from Ashland, says the strategy, Kotek's strategy, runs squarely against some of our core values as Democrats: open government, citizen empowerment, transparency. The growing discomfort that the delay distorts the normal initiative process would be erased, in my view, he writes, if you, and he's addressing Tina Kotek, were to sign the bill now instead of waiting till the statutory deadline. Signed, Senator Jeff Golden, Democrat from Ashland. To your calls now. Let me start with Arlene. Hey, Arlene, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have called before, but anyway, I work for the state of Oregon Department of Human Services for years, actually. Started in the mid-70s when it was food stamps and issued many, many benefits. And it was all based on policy and laws. I mean, we get laws, federal laws, saying these people qualify, and we had to document and verify it all before we give them anything at all. And then what sanctuary states, when that thing came to happen, nobody gave us a clear definition of what that meant. But basically it was understood that we could no longer question anybody. We could not ask for documentation unless it was questionable, but we couldn't question them. In other words, the application was the truth.
I mean, doesn't that sound crazy, Arlene? Don't ask for something. Don't question it unless you find a reason to question. And we've just told you don't question it.
Right. Right. Wow. And then we had to give those benefits the same day. So it wasn't even, we couldn't even wait. And, you know, we used to have like a 30-day window, actually 45-day window, to get all the documentation that we needed in order to open up the grants. And of course, you know, they were reviewed by the federal government. The feds came in, and what was happening was that we were being dinged for giving illegal aliens benefits that they weren't entitled to, and then we were causing overpayment on those federal grants. I mean, so then we had to take them off the benefit and then write up overpayments and try to collect it.
Let me ask you something, Arlene. In 87, when Oregon became the first state in America to call itself a sanctuary state for illegals, at that point, if you can't ask somebody the questions to find out if they're illegals, then as far as you're concerned, everybody who walks in the office is a legal resident American who can apply for food stamps, right? Because you're not allowed to ask, right?
Right, right. If they mark, I mean, I like my questions always when I went into training was, well, what, you know, many of them didn't speak English or understand. I mean, we had Russians, we had, you know, Hispanics, we had, I mean, you know, I I had interpreters, but I didn't understand the language. And so I wasn't real sure sometimes what that all was about. But anyway, no, you would wonder if they understood what they were applying for.
And, of course, you weren't allowed to say, by the way, are you legally in America? Because the state of Oregon decides don't ask, don't tell when it comes to illegals. Thanks, Arlene.
The Lars Larson.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You know, I'm half tempted to call Jack Smith the Joe Biden hatchet man, because I think that's actually what he did. But he allegedly spied on the senators, United States senators from a Republican party. So I thought I'd talk to one of them who's also coincidentally running for governor of the state of Tennessee. She is Senator Marsha Blackburn from the great state of Tennessee. Senator, welcome back.
I am always delighted to join you. Thank you so much. And yes, indeed, it was 9 U.S. senators that Jack Smith chose to spy on. And when you look at the fact that he is pulling these records, the phone records from U.S. senators and doing this to us, and went to court, got a subpoena, and pull the records for everybody we talked to or that called us, we called them or they called us, and then where we were physically standing when we took that call or made that call and the duration of the call. So that is how invasive this was. And, Lars, it's a violation of our First and Fourth Amendment rights. It's a violation of the speech and debate clause and the separation of powers, things that are constitutional. It's a violation of the Stored Records Act.
And by the way, Senator, I mean, I'm not making light of it, but does that mean that times that you and I have talked on the air or off the air, that those are also in Jack Smith's set of records that he thought were somehow justified by his investigation?
Well, he probably did. And yes, you know, I told my family, think about this. A number of times we talked about what was happening with one of the grandkids. That's none of Jack Smith's business.
No, it's not. And what I'm wondering is why there isn't more public outrage about the fact that you had an American president who had created this special counsel, and the special counsel is investigating United States senators from the opposition party. Any sign that Jack Smith took a look at Democrats at all?
No, what he did, the commonality, and let me say this, we don't have the predicate that they took to court. And Boasberg, who is a leftist judge, is who signed off on these subpoenas. So we don't know the predicate other than the Christopher Wray memo from April 4th of 2022. And then Merrick Garland approved the memo the next day to put Jack Smith in place. And it was one of these. There might have been, could have been, maybe was. Could have happened with some alleged actions that related to the 2020 elections. It was that kind of memo. It's on my social media at Marsha Blackburn. People can actually go read the thing. And what we know is the only thread is we were all Republicans who supported President Donald Trump and had valid questions about the 2020 election. And past that, we don't know. What we have learned through other documents that Jack Smith issued 197 subpoenas, all to conservative groups or to surveil conservatives. That is what we do know. And we know that because it's coming from whistleblowers.
Well, let me ask you this. If Boasberg signed off on this, you know, federal judges can be impeached. I often end up explaining this to my audience. Well, can we remove these people? I said, well, they can through impeachment. But I'm short of impeachment. Would it be legitimate for the Congress to call Judge Boasberg in to testify under oath about why he would sign off on an investigation like this and how it could be legally justified if no crime was suspected?
Yes, and what you will see, we will do hearings at Senate Judiciary pertaining to Jack Smith, Chris Wray, Lisa Monaco, Merrick Garland, and the House is who will do the investigation into Judge Boasberg, because they're the ones that would begin impeachment and removal proceedings.
Now, what about Smith? What should happen to Jack Smith? Should he at least be disbarred for spying on GOP senators?
Yes, and we have already sent a letter over to DOJ, to AG Bondi, calling for him to be referred to the Office of Professional Conduct for an investigation. And that's where the disbarment begins. He is licensed in Tennessee and New York, and we will move to have him disbarred. But beyond that, not only Jack Smith, but everybody that was in that CR 15 unit that participated in this spying operation, they need to be held accountable to the full extent of the law.
Well, and because I'm talking to Senator Marsha Blackburn, who's running for governor of Tennessee, but she's currently a U.S. senator and doing a great job. Well, I'm glad we all just get a chance to talk to you. But tell me this. Those people who did that, and Jack Smith, did they commit crimes by doing this?
Yes, they did, because of the violation of the First and Fourth Amendment, the abridgment and violation of the speech and debate clause, and of the separation of powers. And yes, there was no predicate for them to do this. And on top of doing the subpoenas, Judge Boasberg laid down a non-disclosure agreement on top of the subpoena to the wireless companies. If they could not tell us about this for a year, they couldn't talk to us, they listed us as flight risk, destroying evidence, all sorts of things. And of course, that's not going to happen. And this is one of the reasons that I think you'll see the House move forward with investigation and then impeachment proceedings.
Okay, because Senator Blackburn, I will be honest with you. One of my biggest frustrations is that I expected great things, and I think I'm seeing great things from the Trump administration. But I also expected we'd start to see indictments and people being brought up on charges. Do you think we've had enough of that yet? And is there a good reason why we haven't seen a lot of that yet? Not just on this case, but on all these cases.
Yeah. Well, and it takes a while to assemble that case and move forward with the evidence. And bear in mind, there's still a deep state. And even though we've been able to figure out who did a lot of this wrongdoing and evil, getting the documentation to move that to court is something that is slow, because the deep state is still alive and well. And, you know, I give Cash Patel a lot of credit. He fired every single person that was attached to Jack Smith's CR 15 unit. We need to see more of that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because Americans are happy with what I think with the leadership that Donald Trump is offering. But we want to see some people indicted. We want to see some wrongdoers who actually face some kind of punishment, at least the prospect of punishment, if they're indicted and then put on trial. By the way, I hope your governor's race is going along well. And at some point, we'll be able to talk more about that. Senator Blackburn, thanks so much for the time.
You got it. Take care.
That is Senator Marsha Blackburn. She is currently United States Senator. I think she's likely to be in the next governor of the state of Tennessee. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And California and its state retirement fund, they invested a ton of money in clean, green energy, and it sounds like they lost their shirt. We'll get into the details of that coming up next. Well,
in a rugged political climate, he's the steamroller. This
is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. I want to talk about clean energy and public pensions. Now, you might say, well, how does clean energy have anything to do with public pensions? I'm going to give you a great example. I suspect it is one of many in the United States, but more attention is paid to the California State Retirement Fund. And it is stunning how dumb this was. I mean, I've always thought that investing in these so-called clean energy deals, whether it's windmills, solar panels, or any of the other schemes, the ones that have to be subsidized with millions or billions of dollars to even make them pencil out financially. But guess what happened? The state of California decided to invest almost $500 million in clean energy projects. Now, for the most part, I see these projects as a giant scam. And here's why I say they're a scam. If you go out and you install solar panels, they may not make any financial sense at all, but you qualify somebody for the financial tax credits, either state tax credits or in more cases, federal tax credits. So an awful lot of so-called clean energy schemes, including biodiesel, windmills, solar panels, things like that, they make money for somebody because of the tax credits that are attached to them. And in other words, it's something stupid. Like if there was a federal tax credit of $10 for every earthworm I took out of my front yard, I'd be out collecting night crawlers every single night. I'd say 10 bucks a worm. I'm going to find a couple of hundred of them. That's a sweet deal. Now, you might think it's kind of stupid to pay a subsidy for something like that. But then again, that's what I think about green energy. When you say, this is the energy of the future. And you say, well, does it make financial sense? Well, yeah, sure it does. If you put enough millions or billions of dollars of the taxpayers' money into it, then it makes financial sense. I've asked people time and again, you mean it doesn't make financial sense without the federal government subsidy? Oh, no, we'll have to subsidize it for a while. Do you know how long we've been subsidizing solar energy in this country? The first solar cells were developed as part of government programs back in the 1950s. Now, most of that was for the space program. You didn't get actual solar panels until the 1970s. And you say, so in other words, we've had some solar panels around for about 50 years. At what point is this stupid thing going to start making money or at least breaking even? I mean, if somebody could come to me and say, Lars, your current electric bill, I think last month's electric bill is about $200. If you said, well, we can give you, we can sell you some solar panels. If you put them on your roof, the cost of putting them up on the roof and hooking them up to your electric will cost you about $200 a month, about the same amount that you're paying to buy the energy from the energy company. At that point, I'd say, well, then that pencils out. That makes sense. If they tell me, oh, it only makes sense if you decide to take the federal and state tax credits, then all you're saying is, anything makes sense if the federal government pays you to do something stupid. I mean, building when Ford Motor Company, I don't drive an electric car or truck. When they came out with that stupid the Lightning pickup truck, the one that cost $120,000 more than they could sell it for, or they were losing a six-figure sum every time they sold one of the pickup trucks. Now, if you could actually make a pickup truck that ran on electricity, where the cost of the pickup truck, when you bought it, actually made some money for the company. And for a while there, a couple of years ago during Biden, Ford Motor Company was making $5 billion a year in selling its gasoline and diesel vehicles. It was losing about $5 billion a year on its electric vehicles. So in other words, they were running sort of a charity where they didn't actually make any money. All the money they made on the gasoline and diesel side, they then lost on the electric side because the government had said, we want you to make electric cars. And if they heard the objection, well, you know, you can't make these things and sell them for as much as they cost to make. Well, make them anyway, because otherwise the government will be very unhappy with you and you have to keep the government happy. In any case, in California, their state pension fund put $468 million into clean energy. Now, we don't know all the details of it. We do know they lost 71% of that nearly $500 million because they put it in green energy. If they had put it in almost any other place, they'd have made money. Instead, they lost almost three quarters of all the money they put in there. And I might mention that when state pension funds lose money on their investments, that doesn't hurt the people collecting the pensions. It hurts the taxpayers because the taxpayers are still on the hook to make up the difference. Let's go to Benjamin, who's a naysayer. Hey, Benjamin, we love naysayers on this program, so welcome. Tell me what you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer.
Sure. What did you think of the Reuters report yesterday pointing out that Trump Organization last year at this time made about $60 million, but this year it's made about $800 million? Gee, what could be different between last year and this year?
Trump is president, and Trump is very popular. But if you're saying the Trump Organization, you are aware that Donald Trump doesn't run the organization. He handed it off to his kids.
Oh, right, right. Yep. So they must be selling a lot more Trump hats, Trump watches, and Trump Bibles, right?
I would think so. So?
Come
well,
on,
no, tell me what's funny about that, because, Benjamin, I'm trying to understand your point. Anybody, if all of a sudden you became a star player in the NBA, jerseys with your name on it, or a player in the NFL, jerseys with your name on it would be bigger sellers than they are likely today, wouldn't they?
Have you ever heard of crypto?
Yes, I've heard of crypto, Benjamin. I don't live under a rock.
Oh, good.
What's your point?
I wonder.
Well, Benjamin, you know what? You've ceased to be interesting, and that's the primary test here. Let's go to John. Hey, John, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hello, Lars. Thanks for taking me on the air.
Sure. What's up?
You know, almost an hour ago, Jennifer tried to give you some good advice, and I recommend you follow it.
What advice?
She asked you a question, and you spun it over to talk about the Biden crime family.
No, what's the question, John, since most of the people listening won't have heard what she said, why don't you tell me what it was that she said that caught your ear? No, tell me what she said that caught your ear, because otherwise the people listening to the program, it's like walking into a conversation and saying, well, an hour ago he said this. The person who just walked into the conversation, including a lot of the people listening to the show, don't have any idea what Jennifer, what reference you're making to Jennifer. So what did she say that caught your ear?
Hey, Lars, I didn't interrupt you.
Okay, I do interrupt people, and I appreciate the call. Let's go to Alma. Hey, Alma, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. We got about a minute. What's on your mind?
Okay, let me talk quick and see. You know, I'm 79. I got to remember this stuff. I like to say when Biden's kids were making all that money, you guys were going over. You guys were upset. How are they making this much money?
Because they were making it illegally, Alma.
Well, they are too.
No, tell me the illegal thing the Trump kids have done. And I'll tell you what Hunter Biden did that was illegal. You tell me what the way that the Trump kids are breaking the law.
Oh my God! They're not supposed to be able to make as much money in the way they make it. But you know what, Lars? I'm gonna get my facts together and I'm gonna call you back.
I want you to, because when Hunter Biden sold favors from the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, that was breaking the law. The Trump kids, they're doing it legally.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's. Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I've got a question, and it's not rhetorical at all. Is religious freedom truly equal across the United States of America, especially because we have a federal constitutional protection of our God-given rights? Or does your zip code actually play a big role in deciding how free your faith really is? Frank DeVito joins me now, who's senior counsel, that means he's a lawyer, and director of content at Napa Legal. How you doing, Frank?
Lars, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great.
Got a great name, Napa Legal. Does that mean you're in wine country and that's That's got to be a good
sadly,
thing.
Sadly, no. Our founders are out in wine country, but I'm other side of the country here in Pennsylvania.
Oh, my goodness. Well, at least you're in a you didn't get stuck in Washington, D.C. But tell me about what is going on here, that your zip code decides how much faith freedom an American has?
In a lot of ways, yes. So you made a really good point in your introduction. Does your religious freedom depend on where you live when we have the First Amendment, right, that protects religious freedom at the federal level across the board? And the answer is yes for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'll say so our study is focused on freedom for religious organizations, right? So you think your pregnancy centers, your classical schools, your charities, soup kitchens, homeless shelters, anything that has a religious nonprofit status. So we're focused not so much on the laws that affect individual religious liberty, although there's a lot of overlap, but on what state laws will help or hinder these organizations to flourish. So yes, there's a lot of variation. But the other thing I'll say about the federal question is, so the First Amendment protects religious exercise, right? Congress shall make no law preventing the free exercise of religion. However, since 1990, the Supreme Court decided a case called Employment Division versus Smith, which severely limited the
application. Now, was that the peyote case? Do I remember that
right? It was.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Not the set of facts you want to – no, not at all. It's not the set of facts you maybe want to be charging forward on this issue. But that aside, what we got out of the Smith case was a ruling that says, okay, if there's a statute that is generally applicable, neutral, right, on its face, it's not discriminating or affecting just a religious organization, right? So a law that says Catholics can't buy wine for mass, that's not neutral or generally applicable.
No.
It's targeting religion, right? But
right.
If you have a law that says you can't buy wine, period, that's neutral and generally applicable. And what the Smith decision said was that if there's a generally applicable neutral law that in fact burdens religious exercise, we're not going to subject that law to a heightened level of scrutiny. It doesn't really run afoul of the First Amendment. So despite our First Amendment protections, they can often be fairly limited if a law appears neutral and generally applicable. So what you have on the state level, the state laws that are on the books, can actually make quite a huge difference in your religious freedom, depending on the state you live in.
I mean, so we can still have laws against sacrificing virgins into live volcanoes, things like that. We can still make that against the law as long as we don't apply it to any particular religious set of beliefs, right?
Well, even if you did, you'd be okay under the Constitution there, I'm pretty confident. So even if the law does run afoul of the Constitution, you still have – the government can overcome that by proving there's a compelling interest and this is the least the least burdensome or the most narrow way to stop that. So we're stopping virgins from being thrown into volcanoes. That probably overrides the religious exercise claim.
And some of this matters a lot because when it comes to organizations, aren't there just a ton of hospitals in America that have a religious underpinning? They may hide it these days out of fear of the woke folks, but an awful lot of hospital systems are based on the original religious order that founded them, and they still believe in those principles, and that would become very applicable if, say, the hospital said, we don't want to do abortions, or we don't want to do certain kinds of, maybe we don't want to mutilate kids in the name of transgender. And you say, well, you can't do that. Those kinds of things become hugely important, don't they?
Yes, they do. Hospitals are huge. Schools, obviously, a lot of religious schools that are educating a lot of people in the country. And so there are a couple of ways that what you have at the state level, the types of laws, matter greatly. And these are some of the laws that we score most heavily in our Faith and Freedom Index. So you have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act at the state level, which is, it basically restores what the government limited in the Employment Division versus Smith case. And says, okay, even if a law is neutral or generally applicable, then at the federal level and in 30 of our 50 states, I believe, you still have to subject that law to strict scrutiny if it does in fact violate religious exercise. So that's a big difference. If a state has a Religious Freedom Restoration Act and there's a lawsuit or a government action that says, nope, you must provide abortions even though you're a Catholic hospital, or you must only, you know, hire all comers regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity. If you have a state Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you can challenge the law, and then the government has a really high burden of proving that they have a compelling reason they're probably going to lose. But there are 20 states in the nation that don't have that Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and it's going to make it a lot harder to prevail on things like that. And then the other state law issue that matters greatly, and I think we're seeing a lot more of this, is, you know, the quote-unquote non-discrimination laws that pretty much every state has some form of them on the books, right? That you can't discriminate when you're offering public programming or when you're making employment decisions on the basis of you know, race, ethnicity, but also sex and religion and sexual orientation and gender identity, depending on the state. And some states have very broad exclusions that say, listen, this is for for-profit employers or, you know, public companies, does not apply to religious organizations. That's helpful. Or at least some will have more narrow carve-outs that say, okay, when these non-discrimination laws are talking about sexual orientation or gender identity or religion, in those cases, at least, it doesn't apply to religious organizations. Some states have no such exemption. Like, if you looked at our Faith and Freedom Index, Michigan, which is at the very, very bottom.
I was going to ask you about Michigan. How did Michigan end up on the bottom end of the NAPA Legal Institute Religious Freedom Index? What were they doing wrong?
Yeah, it's. I mean, the biggest, most heavily weighed factors are the ones I just mentioned. So they don't have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and they have very wide non-discrimination laws with almost zero exemptions for religious organizations. And you've seen there was a case a couple of years ago called Sacred Heart v. Nestle, where the Michigan state agencies doubled down and said, no, if you're a Catholic school, doesn't matter. You cannot make hiring decisions based on religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, and so on. And so those are the biggest ones. There are really very few protections in Michigan for against non-discrimination laws. They have some bad regulations, too, but I'd say that those are probably the biggest.
By the way, do you publish this list so my audience can go check out the Religious Freedom Index?
Yes, thank you. So if you go to our website, we're the NAPA Legal Institute, right on the homepage right now, because we just launched the latest edition on Monday. Right on the homepage, you'll see a link to the Faith and Freedom Index, and you can get to it from there.
Okay, so I got to ask about the other end. Alabama scores 86, highest in the country, but they still fell short. Where does Alabama fall short?
Yeah, so they're 86 on religious freedom, a little lower on regulatory freedom. So we also look at some practical things for religious organizations, right? How easy is it to get tax exemptions or exemptions from burdensome regulations and so on? So they're very good on the religious liberty side. One of the more minor factors, but that plays in, a lot of states have passed laws protecting religious exercise during a state of emergency, right? We saw the importance during COVID. Yep. So some states have passed laws saying, okay, if there's a pandemic or some kind of emergency, the governor cannot shut down religious worship, or at least not without compelling reason. So Alabama does not have any particularly strong protections for state of emergency. And then there are just a couple of regulatory side issues. Their corporate governance laws, their sales tax exemptions are not perfect. So, yes, we're nitpicking, but the whole point of this index is every state can do better if they want to pass laws to protect religious organizations and the important work that they do.
Well, I got to tell you, Frank, I'm glad to see that you're nitpicking, because otherwise you end up with Governor Cuomo sending out his spies to look in the windows of your synagogue during the pandemic and spy on whether or not you're actually in there praying or not. And frankly, I want to keep us away from the territory where Great Britain got to, where you can be arrested just for standing on a street corner and saying a silent prayer. I don't want America ever to fall victim to that kind of nonsense. That is Frank DeVito, Senior Counsel and Director of Content at NAPA Legal. Back in a moment. I'll get you your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LawrenceLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we're glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. This segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists at Oregon Medical Centers. Now, let me go to your calls. Let me start with Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. What's on your mind? Hey, Jim. Did Jim miss out on his opportunity? Well, I guess he did. If he's not there, he's not there, so too bad. Hey, I did want to mention this. Governor Kotek went off on a junket to Asia. She brought her wife with her. Yeah, you heard me right. She brought her wife with her. Her mentally ill and alcoholic wife went with her to Asia. Cost to taxpayers about $200,000. which shows, among other things, things that we already know about Tina Kotek, which is she doesn't give a damn about you as a taxpayer. And further proof of that is the fact that, well, let me get into the details of that in a moment. I am curious about what Jim wanted to talk about. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. Are you there?
I am here.
Okay, what's on your mind?
Well, I ran into a guy in business the other day, and I was kind of taken back because he told me that he was participating in the ICE facility protests.
Did he tell you why?
So, not really. We didn't get into that because, let's just say that I wasn't real interested in his political view at that point. But the one thing I wanted to mention to you that was curious, I said, well, geez, it's kind of interesting that all these people are buying the costumes just so that they can make it appear that it's more out of a, not political, it's just playful. And he goes, yeah. Well, we don't buy them. I said, well, what do you mean you don't buy them? He goes, there's a tent there. And he says, you just go in and pick out what you want.
I don't doubt it. I have a feeling that this is a well-financed effort. Could I prove where the money's coming from? No. But the evidence you just offered up, if they're able to walk in and get all these supplies, in fact, when they got the clean-out done this last weekend, the police found medical supplies, boxes full of masks, I mean, meaning masks you wear over your face, all these things, a refrigerator, all kinds of things, medical kits, things like that. This is a well-financed effort, and it's aimed at pushing a political point of view. And I think you're exactly right about the costumes. The minute they started to get the attention from Trump, which was about a month ago, September, I think the 27th of September was the day that Trump said, okay, I'm sending the National Guard. They immediately shifted what they were doing. They went from black masks and stuff to camouflage who they were, the little playful costumes and the inflatable costumes. I think what they're trying to do, and the media, unfortunately, has been cooperating with them. Whenever you see a story now about those protests, so-called protests, riots, and obstruction, which is what they're engaging in, they're trying to keep ICE from doing its job. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But the minute they go from people who are dressed up like ninjas to people who are dressed up like, you know, inflatable hot dogs, they're trying to send the message that, yeah, this is just, you know, the usual Portland weirdness. Don't worry about it too much. Except that it's very serious in my point of view. You've got a federal government with laws that have been on the books for decades. You've got a president, finally a president this year, who's actually interested in enforcing those laws. And then you've got a bunch of hoodlums, terrorists from Antifa, who say, we're not going to let the federal government enforce the law. Now, what should any American make of that? No matter how they feel about the subject of illegal aliens, no matter how they feel about ICE, what should you make of people who say we're going to deliberately get in the way and keep federal law from being enforced?
Well, I think more tear gas might do it.
I think more tear gas is a terrific idea because, frankly, I've seen so many videos where these hoodlums, they get right up in the faces of cops. They get right up in the faces of members of our military and they scream at them. They curse at them. They do all this stuff. And then eventually, if they step across the line, they get a face full of bear spray. As far as I'm concerned, I would think that if you put up a GoFundMe to buy more cans of bear spray for either the ICE facility, the Federal Protection Service, or for the National Guard, you'd get a ton of donation.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Hey, I'm glad to do it, Jim, because at the end of the day, do you know the weekend that Kristi Noem, or the week that Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem showed up in Portland, she showed up to check out what was going on at the ICE facility. That weekend, they arrested 51 illegal aliens who were also accused criminals. That is, they were people who were suspected of committing crimes, not just the crimes of obstructing ICE, but also other criminal matters. And they took them into custody, or they took them into custody and made sure that the charges were going to be applied. Let me tell you some of the results of the survey that was done by Riley Research. It just came out. The Oregon Taxpayers Association of Oregon has published this now. They asked people in the state of Oregon about this $4.3 billion tax hike that Governor Kotek refuses to sign because she's delaying the effort to gather signatures and put it on the ballot so that people can vote on it. 67% of them said they would vote to repeal the taxes. That's two-thirds of them. 21% said they would vote to keep the taxes. 82% opposed the 6-cent gas tax increase. 81% opposed the registration fee increase. And 86% of the voters would be willing to sign a petition to put the tax and fee increases on the ballot. And Tina Kotek is obstructing in the same way that the Antifa terrorists down at ICE are trying to obstruct. Tina Kotek is obstructing democracy, and she calls herself a member of the Democrat Party. You've got the Lars Larson Show. The Lars.